Okay. Okay. The last talk we have before the break is by John Soles, who is an old friend, known for a long time and age-wise, from the Maine Department of Marine Resources. He's going to talk about the Taunton Bay Management Experiment, protecting eelgrass amidst. Conflicting uses.
I just need to be checked out on the little. I don't think I need it. Can you hear me out there? I need a mic. And that's the point. Great, thanks, Phil. The Taunton Bay project really is fairly comprehensive and complicated, and so what I'm going to talk about today is really just one little sliver of what we've been doing over the last several years. But first I thought I'd start off by sort of confronting you a little bit, or challenging you to think about things here, eelgrass, mussels, and people. As invasive species, at least they can certainly dominate a system. I was telling somebody in the back, I hate going to meetings and preaching to the choir, and so I thought I'd put that in there just to get you going. Taunton Bay is in eastern Maine, and that's about what it looks like from the air. It's a very small bay, but it's been one that's had a concentration of a lot of controversy. Only 3,700 acres, and the reason that I'm pointing these parameters out to you is that it is small, it's a manageable bay, it has a fairly large watershed, it has a very high flushing rate, so when it comes to water quality issues and water clarity, you can see that on a drain tide, it loses well over two-thirds of its water. It has a diversity of plants and animals and quite a bit of human activity, including commercial fisheries, and that's the conflict that Phil was referring to a second ago. But to set the base, it also has an awful lot, an abundance and diversity of wildlife uses. You can read down that list for yourself. It includes everything from shorebirds to fish to different vegetative habitats, a whole host of invertebrate species, eagles' nests, seal haulouts, pupping areas, and that sort of thing. This is a nice little project that Steve Perrin put together a few years back for a larger statewide pilot project. And it's actually one of the, and I want to give Steve the credit for actually instigating the state as a whole, towards looking at the bay as a system. This began back around 1999. The Department of Transportation was going to replace a bridge that would have raised the elevation of the bridge to allow larger draggers, mussel draggers, into the bay. The folks around the bay became quite concerned. They were aware of the diversity and the richness of life in the bay that I just showed in the previous slide. They went to the legislature, passed a prohibition on dragging in the bay beginning in 2000. Interestingly, the year following that, or maybe it was two, the eelgrass died back for some unknown reason. It certainly wasn't because of dragging, but there was about an 80-90% loss of eelgrass in the bay. The other thing that it did, though, was that it locked up a valuable commercial resource and prevented folks from accessing it. And in fact, a couple of years into that moratorium, we had a red tide event that basically shut down the entire coast. And so at that time, when Taunton Bay was locked up, the commercial sector was pretty upset, really, that they couldn't access the product that they could use to sustain their businesses and families. The moratorium came to a close in about, it was in 2008. It sunsetted, And we needed to have something in place to catch this system that would now be opened up to dragging. How would we manage this? It wasn't a question of keeping it off limits. The legislature made it very clear that they weren't interested in locking it out. They basically threw the challenge down to us to see if we could come up with a plan that would protect the natural resources, but yet also protect the human communities in there. What I mean by the stars aligned, we had just come through a statewide bay management study, much like what Robert was referring to that they're doing in Massachusetts. So the legislature and the political atmosphere was pretty receptive to this sort of thing. I'd also point out that the plan that we came up with was not just a fisheries plan to address dragging or mussel dragging. It was fairly comprehensive. We address it, it's on the web, and I'll give you that address at the end. It addresses everything from water quality protection, to shorebirds, to wildlife, to horseshoe crabs, and eelgrass. It's a little bit different than the Forest Biodiversity Project. For those of you who are here in Maine are familiar with that, where you're dealing with a very few private landowners. Here we're dealing with a public resource that's owned, and the rights are given to people from as far away as Millinocket to somebody who lives on Taunton Bay. That's in the state constitution. So we had a lot of stakeholders involved. What the plan does that I think is a little bit, I mean, we talk about this all the time. It's in the National Academy of Sciences book on ecosystem management, base management, etc. But we did, in fact, or we do, in fact, have measurable ecological and human community targets that we can go back and measure to see whether or not we're headed in the right direction. We have dual and equal goals. We have the goal of protecting the ecological functions as well as managing for human use and enjoyment, obviously for long-term use is a key phrase there. So for Fred, here we're getting into the policy and the politics of it here. The cornerstones of this plan are three: science, stewardship, and adaptability. I think the thing that I think is fairly unique about the Taunton Bay Project is we're using a lot of local knowledge, anecdotal information anecdotal information that's repeated year after year is actually somewhat quantitative, and we have benefited quite heavily from that being available. We also have benefited by a number of people have been interested in Taunton Bay because of its size, because of its proximity to the university, to actually several universities, University of Maine at Machias, as well as the Orono campus. A number of studies have gone on there, and the dieback certainly helped with that. It attracted quite a bit of attention. Stewardship. Our notion is that everyone, not just the commercial harvesters, but everyone in the watershed and everyone who uses and appreciates that bay is responsible for something, for doing something to help protect it. And it could be as simple as attending a meeting or actually participating in a resource assessment. And adaptability. This has been key, I've found, in our project, because we've made a lot of mistakes, and the point here is that we've admitted that we've made those mistakes and we've tried to address those. Okay, now to the reason why we're here for eelgrass, the conflict. We've heard all morning about the value of eelgrass as habitat, all the functions and services that it provides. Mussels are also a valuable community, and they're also a valuable commodity to the economy, especially in this part of the state of Maine. Bottom dragging is really the preferred, I won't say it's the only method, but it is the preferred method given the low price per unit of mussels. Unlike other fisheries or shellfish fisheries like oysters, which have a high landed value, mussels have a very low landed value, and so it's really a bulk type commodity or harvest method. During the moratorium, the folks attempted and did successfully hand harvest with pitchforks into skiffs, but it was economically very expensive and inefficient. The paradox. We heard a little bit about a paradox in one of the previous talks. Interestingly, the relationship between mussels and eelgrass is quite tight. Mussels benefit quite well. I don't know that they I don't know that it's obligate, but certainly it's been well documented and reported about the value of eelgrass habitat as the primary settling point for larval mussel spat. And those mussels do best, mussel beds do best at the edges and adjacent to eelgrass beds. And so, in one sense, you've got one species that's attracting another, which is attracting the third, the human species, to come in after it, and you have this the conflict. Taunton Bay. This is a composite, really, of the historical beds, the greenness, I guess, inside the bay itself is the historical limits in general. Steve Perrin has a really nice poster out back that actually has some aerial photography that goes back to, what, 1956-ish, Steve?
55.
And so it may not correspond exactly. I'd look at his more closely than this. But the point here is that the eelgrass habitat is a dominant habitat in Taunton Bay. The rest of the bay, the area where there is no eelgrass, and you saw from the aerial photo, is primarily mudflat. So you have a mudflat eelgrass system. Dragging disturbance, we talked about a little bit earlier. Obviously, there's the short-term effect of cutting off the fronds. Then you have the larger effect of the eelgrass being uprooted, a little bit longer-term recovery. You have turbidity. And then if there is a valuable resource there, a mussel resource, you have the repeated dragging that goes on continually, which does prevent any sort of reseeding or recolonization. And I'll show you a little bit about that right here. Typical bottom drag, you have a bar going across this way. This happens to be a scallop drag for anybody with keen eyes. But the rings are smaller in the mussel drag. The bar peels off that layer of the mussel mat. And in so doing, if there happens to be eelgrass in the way, it'll take the eelgrass with it. Generally, the harvesters don't like to get in the eelgrass if they can avoid it, because it is a mess when it comes to cleaning out the catch and sorting through the catch. Here's one of Hillary and Blaine's and Seth's and Fred's photos up in McCoy Bay, and I think most of you have seen this, but this is a fairly large scar. And then there's Hillary up there in her little boat. And this is five, I think it actually might be 7 years later, but you can still see it. And I think the conclusion of their paper was that it could be 10, 12, maybe even up to, in some cases, 20 years that it would take for a scar like that to heal. And if you've got, again, if you've got mussel beds in an area, for those of you from the MDI area, Jane, this is Raccoon Cove, those drag marks, or those drags, will continuously go back and forth there. And even if it is potential eelgrass habitat, you'd be hard-pressed to recolonize it. The other part of mussel dragging, though, is a little bit I don't think people appreciate. On the stern of these boats, the drag is emptied into this tumbler, and that tumbler is lowered into the water, and it spins the mud out. And here's an example of a plume that is taking place as he's driving around, just washing out his mussels. The plume can be quite extensive. This actually happens to be combined effect. They had just harvested off of these three bars, and then you can see the trail as they're washing their mussels there. So it can be quite extensive, but it is also fairly short-lived, and it doesn't happen more than a couple of times a year at any particular location. So you'll see in the end, one of the questions that we have is, that, you know, what's the cost of doing that, and how frequently is that done, or can that be done without harming the eelgrass? So we have this eelgrass bay with a commercially valuable product locked up in it. And we had all these questions. What's sustainable? What is disturbance? What's high value? You know, Magnuson Stevens talks about these things. The Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission talks about these things. Our own state statutes talk about these things. Robert's hierarchy talks about these things. But as we heard, it's fairly subjective. Well, we didn't even try to answer those. We just went and we said, let's just do the best we can. And again, with the feedback and the measurable objectives, that's the plan. We pulled together a lot of stakeholders. We chose not to look at eelgrass plants, but instead look at the bay as a whole. Is it the habitat value to the bay? We also looked at all the other parts, ecological parts of the bay, and set the measurable targets. In this case, we arbitrarily selected a goal of trying to maintain or to achieve 90% of the coverage that you saw in that earlier GIS file. We also have set some water quality targets of 2 micrograms per liter of chlorophyll, again, to reach this water clarity. And I forgot to look for sure, but I think it was a 4 meter second disc, which is, if I remember right, is two and a half times that's the compensation point. And so that would get us down, actually it would get us down fairly deep into Taunton Bay itself. One of the first things we did is we needed to look at all the subtitled benthic fisheries, and Slade Moore, who's also here, put this report together and came up with the different constraints. In other words, where are the horseshoe crab spawning areas? Where are the juvenile fish habitat areas? Where are the deep water kelps? But also, where are the eelgrass beds over time, and which are the ones, and what sort of management should we apply to those eelgrass beds? And he came up with 5 recommendations. No dragging in existing beds, and that seemed to be fairly easy no-brainer. We also discussed a 100-foot buffer. We chose not to go with that this time around, but it's still on the table for the future. Drag only during ebb tide. Well, as it turns out, that ebb tide, flood tide, the sediment plume is going to go somewhere, and it's going to impact something downstream. We also chose not to to do that. Minimize intensity, in other words, the frequency and how often these areas are dragged, and avoid persistent beds that have been there year after year after year. We did choose to stick with minimize intensity and avoid the persistent beds.